Okay, we begin. This week's Parsha is Adal Parsha, Parsha's Matot and Masai. We are going to focus upon the first Parsha, Matot. I'll share my screen. You'll see the sheet I sent out. And our goal really is to deal with the mitzvah that comes out of this Parsha, actually two mitzvahs that come out of this Parsha, which is the mitzvah of Hechsher Kalim, the mitzvah of koshering vessels that became non-kosher, either because you got them from a non-Jew who used them previously, or there was a mistake in the kitchen and they got trafed up and you need to do Hechsher Kalim, you know, koshering of the Kalim. And certainly, obviously, it comes very, very relevant on Pesach when many people tend to kosher many of their silverware and other things so they can use them for Passover as well. So that's one thing. And also another mitzvah, which is a debate if it's from the Torah or from the rabbis, which is the idea of tefillat kelim, the immersing of vessels that are purchased from a non-Jew. You know, you go regular new glass or metal silverware or pans and the like. So we're going to understand what that mitzvah all about. It seems a little bizarre. You know, you got to dip your you got to boil out your dishes and then you got to dip them in the mikvah. I mean, it seems like a strange ritual. So we're going to add some clarity to that. And, we're going to start with the obvious first stop, which is the 2017 Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest. So let's get into that, which is our first stop in our journey of the mitzvah here. So let's share screen the video. Okay. There we go. All right. I don't know if you want to watch any more of this disgusting shoving of hot dogs down people's throat here, but this is taken from ESPN, where on July 4th or early this month they had the Coney Island Nathan's hot dogging contest been going on for like, I don't know, 75 years at least, and this guy Joey Chestnut, in fact, he did win with something like 81 hot dogs, something ridiculous. But let me ask some basic questions. Why is this being done on July 4th?
Because everyone's eating like a barbecue, like on July 4th, everyone's eating hot dogs.
Okay, now everybody's eating hot dogs, but I don't know about you, but I don't think you're having 80 hot dogs.
No.
I don't think you're having 50 hot dogs. I don't think you're having 10 hot dogs. At the most outer realm, you might be having 3 hot dogs in the most extreme possibility. Okay, so how did this become a whole thing? What's it? I mean, it's very nice, but what's the? Why is this? What's it got to do with July 4th? Okay, I know we're eating hot dogs, but now you're, what's up with eating like? The fact that this guy is able, and it's, by the way, there's a science to it. It's not just simply you can get up one day and just eat 50, 75 hot dogs. You gotta work by training, expanding your stomach to 400% of its size. You gotta strengthen your jaw muscles so you can chop the stuff down like a shark, whatever. And you got to practice, whatever. It's disgusting. Anyways, and you see, what was the scene there? Was there, What did you see in the crowd? Describe the crowd.
They were excited. It was like a spectator sport.
And what were they wearing on their head? Shane, what were they wearing on their heads? I don't know if they caught that clip in the beginning part.
I saw the referees or the judges and like the black and white stripes wearing, I think, yellow hats, but I didn't catch what the crowd
was. They were hot dog hats. All right, so, you know, Coney Island was filled with people, you know, watching, and they're all wearing their hot dog, Nathan's hot dog hat, cheering the guy on to success over there. And, but how does that fit in? Nobody's explained. Just because on July 4th we have hot dogs, what does that got to do with the hot dog eating contest? What's the connection here?
I don't know the history, but Nathan's, I guess, sponsored a hot dog eating contest on some July 4th, and they've been doing it every year since.
They have, but why does it strike as such a powerful chord? Sean?
Is it somehow tied to the fact that it's Independence Day? Like they're doing it on Independence Day and not another holiday.
Right, they're doing it on the holiday of July 4th. And welcome, Moshe Chaim Dodes.
Hey guys, sorry I'm late. And hey, Mark, good to see you.
So we just played the clip of the Nathan's hot dog eating contest, and which is always on July 4th. And I asked everybody here how is it related to July 4th? So everybody said, well, that's the day we eat hot dogs. Yeah, but I asked, well, most of the guys can eat three hot dogs. You're not going to eat eight hot dogs. So Michael, what do you think? What's the connection here? And why there's so much enthusiasm about the thing? It's a bizarre. I mean, if a Martian came from outer space and descended on this, I don't think you'd be able to figure this out. So what's going on?
Well, July 4th is Independence Day, celebrating freedom. So people have the freedom to eat 80 hot dogs if they want, or 30.
Okay. So that's a major feature. The reason why this, I think, it fits in thematically and catches a curiosity is, what is the feature of all holiday celebrations, nearly in all cultures, with all people?
Food.
Not just food. You have good food and a crazy abundance of food. All holidays in nearly every culture is identified by having huge banquets or feasts and therefore overeating. So to dramatize that, they're not just that guy's just eating a hot dog. He's going to eat 80 hot dogs and be the biggest hot dog holiday fresser of the country. Okay? Does that fit in? Does that make sense?
I think it does, but there are like other like food eating contests like throughout the year that aren't exactly tied to holidays.
No, I'm not saying that this has not become a sport in its own right. Mm-hmm. Because it has, but they don't have the hot dog eating contest on June the 4th.
Right, but I think it's because Nathan's being a hot dog company. It's like a marketing gimmick for them to people to associate Nathan's with like July 4th and hot dogs. So it's like
right. So obviously, it's a big deal when they're selling their product or they want people to eat their product. Correct, 100%. But they can't just. But if in order for it to be a successful gimmick, it has to fit in thematically with the day.
Right.
The character of the day is a day when people are involved in celebratory eating. And that means celebratory overeating. Mm-hmm. So let's I'm bringing this up. This is a halakha that we have certainly done over the last nearly 2 years. But let's have some. This is the laws of in regards to eating when it comes to our holidays. All right, so Moshe Chaim, read us some laws of resting on Yontif.
Oh, great. It is forbidden to fast or recite eulogies.
Hold on.
Sorry. On the 7 days of Pesach, the 8 days of Sukkot, and the other holidays. On these days, a person is obligated to be happy and in good spirits. He, his children, his wife, the members of his household, and all those who depend on him, as it states, and you shall rejoice in your festivals. The rejoicing mentioned in the verse refers to sacrificing peace offerings, as will be explained in Hilchot Hagiga. Nevertheless, included in this rejoicing is that he, his children, and the members of his household should rejoice, each one in a manner appropriate for him.
Okay, so the Ram says that the mitzvah v'samata bechagecha, you should rejoice in your holiday, has one thing that is special. There used to be offerings; we'd all be on Rosh in the Mikdash, and therefore you would have as your lunch meal. It would be basically the meat from these offerings. But in addition to that, there's a general obligation for the head of the household to make every member of the household happy. And then he explains it. Go on.
What is implied? Children should be given roasted seeds, nuts, and sweets. For women, one should buy attractive clothes and jewelry according to one's capacity to do so. Men should eat meat. Should eat meat and drink wine, for there is no happiness without partaking of meat, nor is there happiness without partaking of wine. When a person eats and drinks v'samata b'chagecha, he is obligated to feed converts, orphans, widows, and others who are destitute and poor. In contrast, a person who locks the gates of his courtyard and eats and drinks with his children and his wife without feeding the poor and the embittered is not indulging in rejoicing associated with the mitzvah, but rather the rejoicing of his gut. And with regard to such a person, Hosea is applied. Their sacrifices will be like the bread of mourners. All that partake thereof shall become impure, for they kept their bread for themselves alone. This happiness is a disgrace for them, as implied by, is it Malachi?
Yeah, Malachi.
I will spread dung on your faces, the dung of your festival celebrations.
Okay, so the Ram has the interesting halacha, which is as follows. There's a mitzvah to have the simcha, which is therefore for kids you get them candy, for women you get them new clothes and jewelry, and for men it's meat and wine. But it's not simply eating that food, it's also ensuring that it becomes a holiday of chesed, that you ensure that people who don't have a place to go for Yontif are invited. Classically in the Torah, the people who were without a house were typically the widows and orphans and poor. Now we don't have so many widows and orphans. We will have more frequently in our time people who are divorced will fit into that category. You know, they don't have a place to be, or poor people. You know, so they, because they're having a yontif alone. So if you would lock them out, if you would actively shun them, then your mitzvah would go from a mitzvah to a disgrace. Would go, instead of what they call simchat shel mitzvah, the joy of the mitzvah, it would be simchat kreso, the simcha, the rejoicing of the gut. It becomes a situation of just purely stuffing yourself. Okay? So the Torah has a cultural, it's taken the Jewish people in a different cultural way. In July 4th, the idea is you get together with your family, and what do? What is the American ideal of July 4th?
You have a barbecue.
You got a barbecue. Who's invited?
Family.
Family and friends. Who is there not a specific obligation to ensure is included?
Strangers.
Right. The poor, strangers, people who don't have. So there's no real clear chesed component. In America, the chesed component to some degree has been added to Thanksgiving. right? So people will work in a shelter. They won't invite them to their house, but they might give money to, you know, Island Harvest or other things to ensure that other people have a July, a Thanksgiving. But the idea of inviting them into your home is a new concept, because the Jewish people view everybody in the Jewish community as their family, and you can't leave anybody out. So that is a completely different cultural objective. Is that clear to everybody? Is that clear? Yeah. Okay. Yes. Good, good, good. Let's keep on going. All right, so let's go to our parsha now. So I'm going to give you a little background. So as you know, over the series of we had the episode with the Jews being involved in the women of both Moab and the women of Midian, okay? God tells Moshe to do a war of revenge against the people of Midian. Why not Moab is interesting. I mean, one reason is that because they were not they felt threatened. They felt threatened. And God set out a war against them. Okay, so the war is a study in its own right. It's an interesting war, and I think I've given that cheer at some point, MG, but you know, sometime over the 11 years I've dealt with it. Okay, so you can look online. The idea of revenge, because the Torah seems that, on one hand, the Torah says you can't take revenge. Yeah, this is a war of revenge. That's the basic question. All right, so let's pick it up. Sean, read out, the Jews come back from their war, and they're given a series of commandments. Go ahead.
You must now remain outside the camp for 7 days. Whoever killed a person or touched a corpse must purify himself on the third and seventh days. And as far as you and your captives are concerned, every garment, every leather article, anything made of goat products, and every wooden article must undergo such purification.
Okay, so what purification are we talking about?
Fire.
No.
No?
Dipping in a mikvah.
Well, they. What does it mean purifying on the third and seventh day? What's the problem? What have they encountered? Remember, it's been a war.
They encountered a dead person.
Right. So you're dealing with they've all had contact with dead people, because they've had hand-to-hand combat and they're dealing with war. So all the things are now what they call tame mate. They have they're defined as being impure in regards to their contact with corpses. So they have to get sprinkled with the water mixture, with water and the ash of what special offering?
The red heifer.
The red heifer. And they get sprinkled on the third day, seventh day, and then on the after the seventh day, that night, what do they do with the object and the people? It goes into the mikvah. Okay? So there's a process of getting purification from the contact of the dead. The basic idea, what is the problem with the coming contact with the dead? I mean, that's really a lot. Okay, I'm asking you a very loaded question, but...
Are you talking about the specific problem with the red heifer, or are you talking about something else?
Well, so I'm just going to give you one rationale. The Rambam, when discussing the mitzvah of this idea of purity or impurity that comes from, you know, the law, the very ornate laws of purity and impurity,
the person who purifies becomes impure. That one, you
know, not that paradox. In regards to what, why have the laws of purity and impurity at all? So one idea is, he brings up in the Mor Avuchim, is the idea of that to ensure the exclusivity of the temple or Mishkan. Because you, if you're a regular Jew, you can be Tameh, but you can't go in contact with, you can't enter into the campus of the Beit HaMikdash or the Mishkan. In order to create exclusivity, one of the reasons of the Torah was that you had to go through a process of Tahara, which is really a rendering of yourself to encounter Kedusha. You know what I'm saying? And this was the mechanism they did by. That's the Rambam's famous reason. There are other reasons. I just wanted to give you sort of something to work with. But we're not done yet. Keep on going. Now let's pick up with Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk 21, Chaval Ged. Sean.
Eleazar the priest said to the soldiers returning from the campaign, "This is the rule that Hashem commanded Moshe. As far as the gold, silver, copper, iron, tin, and lead are concerned, whatever was used over fire must be brought over fire and purged, and then purified with the sprinkling water. However, that which was not used over fire need only be immersed in a mikveh. You yourselves must also immerse your bodies and your garments on the seventh day, and you will then be clean so that you can enter the camp."
Okay, so this is a little interesting. Now, there seems to be something else going on. There's another process. What is this process being referred to here?
Fire.
Okay, a little more expansion on that, Sean. What do you mean by fire?
Well, purify something with fire versus sprinkling the...
Okay, so what do you mean? What is being purified with fire?
Like metals, like the gold, silver, copper?
Right. So typically, it seems that they're talking about stuff that the vessels that people would use, cooking vessels. So this is a source of the laws of Hechsher Kalim, of purifying the whole thing. Let's go to the Ramban. Let me have Michael Dodes. This is from the Ramban, Nachmanides. Go ahead.
Okay. Kashering a vessel which has non kosher absorbed into them.
Just read the English.
Okay, fine. "You shall pass through fire and it will be purified." Purifying scripture refers to removing ritual contamination. Can passing through fire purify in this manner? The Rambam explains. "The implement that touched a human corpse or animal carcass and thereby became contaminated does not become purified through fire. For the Torah's immersion of a person or object for ritual purification is exclusively in water. And therefore, our sages of blessed memory were compelled to explain that this purification mentioned here is not to remove ritual contamination from the implements, but to purge them from the traces of forbidden foods that they absorbed while in the possession of the non-Jews. And this is the true meaning of the verse without doubt."
Okay, so the Ramban asserts that the fact that there's a thing that things that are that were used over fire must brought over water, and those which are this is talking about not talking through a process of the tahara, but rather talking about a kashering. Okay, so already you can see what the word tahara is being used in how many senses?
Referring to that of touching corpses and that of non-kosher food.
Right. So one is talking about ritual contamination or purity, whatever you want to call that. It doesn't really defy that. And then there's a contamination or a purification from removing the non-kosher food absorptions out of the vessel. And they use the word vitaher. But that's not all. We're going to go, that's the Ramban. Now we're going to do, add to the Ramban, we're going to use the Ramban, and we're going to explain it all. Hopefully. That's the goal. All right, so let's do the next mitzvah that's associated with the very same pasuk. All right, Michael Doe, keep on going.
Okay. "The immersion of the dinnerware that is purchased from Gentiles to allow it to be used for eating and drinking is not associated with ritual purity and impurity. Instead, it is a rabbinic decree. There is an I'm not sure what that describes Moshe's instructions.
There is a... Oh, maybe it's got messed up. I guess this is referred to. This describes Moshe's instruction in regard to the spoils taken from number 3123 alludes to this. Go on.
Everything that can be passed through fire, you shall pass through fire, and it will become pure. Midian, according to the oral tradition, we learned that this verse is speaking only about purifying the utensils from Gentile cooking, not from ritual impurity. For there is no ritual impurity that is dispelled by fire. All those who are impure ascend from their impurity through immersion, and the impurity stemming from contact with the human corpse is dispelled through the sprinkling of the red heifer ashes. There is no concept of fire in this context. Rather, it is employed with regard to, and our sages said, it will become pure, purification from Gentile cooking. Since the verse states
I'm not happy. When I copied it, got messed up, and I was going to go and
You want to fix it or read it?
I want to fix it. Give me a second here. Yeah, it's not. Yeah, it's all messed up. Hey, it's always something. All right. Bear with me for 1 second. I'm going to get the right English. Do you see the Rambam here that I'm bringing up?
No, I don't see where you're working right now.
Okay, I'm going to now make a new share screen. Hold on, new share screen. Okay, you see that, right?
Yeah, now we see it.
Hold on. Okay, let's take it from here already. We'll make it a little bit bigger here. Let me make it a little, make it interesting. Let's hold on. Here we go. All right. Take it from 5 and I'll fix it. Okay, take it again.
The immersion of the dinnerware that is purchased from Gentiles to allow it to be used for eating and drinking is not associated with ritual impurity, with ritual purity and impurity, instead, it's a rabbinic decree. There's an allusion to this that describes Moshe's instruction with regards to the spoils taken from Midian. Everything that can be passed through fire, you shall pass through fire, and it will become pure. According to the Masorah, we learn that the verse is speaking only about purifying the utensils from Gentile cooking, not from ritual impurity. For there is no ritual impurity that is dispelled by fire. All those who are impure ascend from their impurity through immersion, and the impurity stemming from contact with the human corpse is distilled through the sprinkling. There is no concept of fire employed in this context. Rather, it is employed with regard to purification from Gentile cooking. Since the verse states, and it will become pure, our sages said, add to it another dimension of purity after passing it through fire to cause it to be permitted because of its contact with Gentile cooking.
Okay, so let me put everything together. So from this putting through fire and then putting in the water, Ramban views that this is the biblical source of koshering, okay? And the Rambam, Maimonides, he says this is actually by... that the harem becomes pure is associated with it. After you do the heksher, you have a rabbinic obligation to bring it to the mikvah. Okay, so if I got a vessel from a non-Jew who used it, I'd have to kosher it, then I had to take it to the mikvah. Or if I bought it brand new, I'd have to bring it to the mikvah. This is what they call an additional purity. So the question we have to ask is one question: what does this got to do with purity or impurity? Okay.
Wait, is this toveling?
Toveling. So the first one is heksher. Heksher, Caleb, is taking if I have a grill that you cooked on the fire, non-kosher hot dogs. I gotta purge it out. I gotta get it red or white hot. And then if it's owned by a non-Jew, I have to then immerse it in the mikvah. If it's a brand new vessel, rabbinically, according to the Rambam and other tools, actually biblically, I gotta take it to the mikvah. And the key thing is a tahara, is a purity. So I am asking you a simple question. What does this got to do with purity? It's not talking about, because the argument that both the Rambam and the Ramban use is that purity is through water, going to the mikvah or getting sprinkled with a special water of the ash water of the parduma for those who have the intense impurity of a corpse. But nothing is about bringing through the fire. So that phenomena is a unique phenomena. And as such, it's associated with a koshering. Okay? So how do you explain this?
Like, why not just put things through fire and declare them pure? Why go the extra step?
Well,
or why do?
In fact, the Rambam said earlier that after 24 hours, biblically, what happens to all the flavor that's absorbed in any vessel?
It's not there. You don't taste it.
Right. It's considered spoiled. So therefore, everything becomes biblically parv after 24 hours. So you know what Eliezer should have told them? Take the vessels and let it sit for a day. And then you use it. But he did not. He wanted them specifically to do a process of a hechsher, and according to some, also toveling, or the Rambam sees this is where the rabbis got the source for toveling, but it's not a biblical mandate. Nachmanides in the same is not sure. He's in doubt. It might be biblical. It might not be biblical. It might be what they call an asmachta, an allusion, but not a remez. He's not sure. He's unsure. So, but it doesn't make a difference. We're looking for the concept here. What is this additional idea of purity?
In regards to koshering or ritual purity?
In other words, beyond ritual purity. So let's say ritual purity is about gaining access to go into the temple area. Okay, fine. But here, they're adding to that. So I'll give you a small hint. Remember, how did this whole war start?
Sexual promiscuity.
Ultimately, yes. Then?
Idolatry.
Well, they had, you missed a step.
The war of revenge by God.
That's way after. The non-Jewish women invited them to...
They were like super successful or something like that, right?
They seduced them. Then they invited them to these holiday, idolatrous holiday parties where they ate. And then they got them to do idolatry itself. It was a multi-step process. It didn't happen in 5 seconds, obviously. So what's going on? That's my hint.
Well, the reason why they did that in the first place was to bring down the Jews spiritually so they wouldn't be protected by God anymore.
True.
So you have to then say that it has to do with guarding that, their spiritual level.
Okay, in what way? True, I'd say you're right in a general sense, yes.
Anyone else want to pick up or should I continue?
Yeah, Sean, what do you say?
You're muted, Sean.
I think it might be related to idolatry.
Okay, be more specific.
Like maybe the Gentiles use like vessels as part of idolatrous activities?
I mean, that, but that's something separate. That they have to actually destroy. Anything which is idolatrous, they can't even keep that.
So that couldn't be kosher?
They can't just kosher a, if a vessel was used for idolatrous service, they got to get rid of it. They got to destroy it. Mm-hmm. That they don't get the chance to recycle. But if you went into the guy's house and you took all of his metal, his knives and forks and his plates, whether they were, you know, tin or silver or gold, whatever they were, that you had a right to use, provided that you went through a hechsher process and also in an additional purification, a tahara yaseira, an additional of the tovelin.
Even if you don't know, what if you don't know whether a person used something for idolatrous purposes? Kind of assuming that they...
Well, you know, again, if you took it out of the temple, you're going to assume that it was idolatrous. If you took it out of the guy's kitchen, it's not for idolatrous.
So then I'm going to assume that somebody who performs idolatry and just, like, say, touches, like, a silverware, then that becomes
impure? No, has to be dedicated for the service. So here's the key thing.
Can I take one more?
Yeah, shot? Michael Doe, keep on rocking here, baby.
So I'm going to guess that has to do with separating Jews from Gentiles, like not drinking wine for the same reasons that it makes it harder to sit down and eat with them, basically. If you can't trust their ingredients, and if you even want to take what's theirs, you have to go through all this process to make sure that it's kosher. No?
But so 1 second. So let it wait a day. But Eliezer told him specifically they got to actively involved in hechsher, even though technically they can let it sit.
So that they can't go to someone's house and say, "Oh, I haven't used that in like a year." Of course, you can eat.
What you're saying is the rabbis say that. The rabbis say that I can't use a vessel that's not been used for a day, lest I end up using a vessel that was used within the day. That's a rabbinic safeguard. But even biblically, he demanded that they do this as part of their reentry into the camp. All of their stuff has got to be kosher and possibly also tovil. Okay?
Then it's just a consecration that you have to have in mind that this is all for God's use and the use of the community, that type of thing.
Okay, but if you bought one, that would be limited to that situation. But we learn from that. That if I go to Bed Bath and Beyond and I buy a frying pan and it's made in China, made by a non-Jew, I have to tovel it. Or if I got a cast iron pan that I bought, a 100-year-old cast iron pan that was been used to fry a bacon every day, so I can use it if I kosher it, you know, if I do libun chazak, if I burn it out, I could use it, and they weren't using it for idolatry. So here's the key point. There's multi layers here. For the getting rid of, for distancing them from idolatry, they had to fight the people, defeat the people. Anything that was used for idolatry had to get rid of. But there's another dimension of that culture. It's a food culture. In other words, in America, you have a food culture, you know, and basically, and the Jewish food culture, as I saw, we have the July 4th hot dog eating contest. That's part of the American or non-Jewish food culture. And then we have the Jewish food culture, which is ideally that our holidays are about chesed or directed toward chesed and mitzvah and having a meal where we have a divrei Torah. Okay, that's our goal. That's a Jewish food culture. So fundamentally, the word tahor is used in a multiple senses. One idea is making accessible to be brought into the temple area, one level. That's the sprinkling. The second thing is really to go back. I don't know if you got, well, Michael will remember this. Do you ever remember the idea called reformatting a disc?
Of course I do.
Right. So In a galaxy far, far away, long time ago, there was a thing called floppy disks that had a teeny bit of data on there. But if you wanted to reuse it, you know, this is going back to my era of high school, whatever. You have to reformat it, basically erase it, and then re-put stuff on it. Okay? So fundamentally, koshering is really, I take the vessel, which was used for non-kosher, I kosher it. It's basically I'm reformatting down to it by cooking out the substance, burning out the substance, boiling out the substance. I'm basically reformatting this vessel. And by then taking to the mikvah, am I giving it a positive identity of the Jewish food culture? And the foolish Jewish culture, ideally, not every Jew attains this, but of course we don't eat everything. We eat kosher food, one. Two is that when we have food, we are thankful. We have brachos before and after. Three, meals and celebrations are mitzvah-centered, weddings, bar mitzvahs, siyumim, Shabbos and Yontif, where you have chesed, invite people in, share divrei Torah. It's a completely different approach to the food culture. Eating food is not a good in its own right. Eating, stuffing our face is not a good in its own right. It's an embarrassment if you're just doing that. It's a simchas kreso. It's a rejoicing of the gut. Well, therefore, they had to reformat all the vessels to a new ideal of eating. Now, I want to show you an example of how powerful we as Jews are susceptible to being attracted to the culture of our surroundings. I'm going to do a simple social experiment. And I'm by showing you a new video. All right, here we go. Okay. I'm not going to show you the whole one, but you can watch it when you're home. This is Jimmy Kimmel.
But I certainly do interest before me?
I don't know, probably like cleaning or something. I can't remember.
Well, I guess I'm honored. By the way, you still have that Guillermo ice sculpture? Because it was a loader I needed for a quinceañera.
All right, get the basic idea. Now, why do I bring this up? Because it's funny. No, I bring this up because this video, I didn't see the Kimmel Live, show, but it was plastered all over Facebook. And in fact, there's a general trend in Facebook is that any time a successful show has some reference to something Jewish, Jews always share it. Now I ask you a simple question. Well, why is that?
Because we're very self-deprecating.
What?
Because we're self-deprecating.
Okay. What else? I don't think people are sharing because we're self-deprecating.
I don't know. It's a bad joke.
It's not often that something positive about Judaism, in this case, this child's bar mitzvah, is always necessarily shared on network TV around the country. And this is something that has an element of humor to it, but also shows some of the beauty of Judaism. And I ended up watching, or I've seen the clip because I saw it on Facebook as well. Instead of giving Jimmy half of what his grandparents gave him, he ended up giving it to a children's hospital in Los Angeles.
Right, that was the end. I didn't. Yes, correct. All right, but I don't think that's the reason why people watch it. I mean, one, of course, is funny. What else?
We all have these touch points in our Jewish education that we relate to, and, you know, whenever it gets a lot of light in the public, we can kind of have our personal connection with the communal connection, and it resonates.
Why is it so appealing to us? In other words, as pure comedy, that's not the funniest thing that Jimmy Kimmel's ever done. It's cute. It's very cute and very... a cute thing.
I think we just like how some of part of Jewish culture has gotten into like pop culture. It's become pop culture. That's one. And second, like, Jews are such a small percentage of the population, and it makes it to, like, national television shows, like, include some of it.
Yeah, well, but why does it give us a little thrill or a little interest? Why does it, when our small culture gets into the mainstream culture, it gives it a little shine, do we like that?
Because it's something positive about Judaism, as opposed to all that anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, and anti-Israel we see everywhere else.
That's certainly true. I think that's that, but it's, I think it's another factor going on as well. I would suggest that reality is that when something's on national TV, or like on a show like Jimmy Kimmel Live, that represents the majority. That means that you've arrived. That means, like, in a certain sense, that you're cool. Jews, if you have most Jews, or Jews typically battle, feel that since we're the minority, what we do is fundamentally intrinsically not cool. When we get validated by Jimmy Kimmel, thinks that the bar mitzvah is a cool thing, it gives us a little bit of a, hey, we're pretty cool. Why are we cool? Because the cool people said we're cool. It's like in high school. It's like if you get a little shine from the popular person in school, it raises up your social stock in the community. So conversely, when our part of our culture gets into the mainstream, we feel good about it because that means that we are significant. I bring this, and the truth is, if you notice, any time something Jewish or Jewish culture gets into a movie or a TV show, that is like immediately like copied and posted on Facebook. Immediately. Regardless of how creative it really is, because, you know, it's been said before many times that a Jew loves the love of the goy. Love to be appreciated by the Gentile because they're the majority. They determine who's cool and who's not. We don't always feel so cool. We need the validation. Which takes us full circle to the verse in Leviticus here. It had Shana.
So you shall set apart the clean beast from the unclean, the unclean bird from the clean. You shall not draw abomination upon yourselves through beast or bird or anything with which the ground is alive, which I have set apart for you to treat as unclean. You shall be holy to me, for I the Lord am holy, and I have set you apart from other peoples to be mine.
That's it. The main point, a main theme in Kashrut, and by definition of Hechsher Kelim, and by extension a Tefillah Kelim, is fundamentally one thing. That one of the ways that we maintain cultural independence that we do not join them on the most basic of cultural connections, which is what? The food culture. One of the ways that Jewish people remain distinct, of course, number one is in our ideas. Number two is in our behavior. But number three is in our food culture. And the fact is that's one of the main themes of the kosher food. And not only kosher food, if we get a vessel from a non-Jew, we have to purge out their culture, reformat the disc by koshering our dishes and putting into the mikveh and re-koshering and say, we have a different identity of food. Food is for mitzvah. Food is to have a healthy body, to do mitzvot. When we eat, we discuss ideas if we have company. We have parties like Shabbos and Yom Tov. We celebrate in a completely different way. So one of the ways that the Jewish people remain distinct is having a autonomous, independent, distinct, completely different food culture. And that's really the kosher. That's the idea of kashrut. I'll stop right there. Questions?
So I'm still a little unclear on like what the actual need for the toveling is. Like, well, why is it just putting it in fire good enough? Like, what's that?
Because that's removal of, biblically, you've removed the residue of their culture, okay? But according to, as Ram says, they add for an additional tahara, additional purification. We're now positively giving it a Jewish identity. You know what I'm saying? Koshering is removing an identity. Hoveling is giving it a new identity, new positive identity. It's now designated for Jewish food use.
So basically it goes from like negative to neutral to then to positive.
Exactly. That's a beautiful way of saying it. With, if I have non-kosher vessels in a negative state, I kosher it to neutrality, and then if I own them, I take them and put them in the mikvah and give it a positive identity of Jewish food use.
Mm-hmm. So along these lines, couldn't just writing it back to like the video, the Jimmy Kimmel video, so couldn't you then kind of say that in reality we as Jews shouldn't be so excited by that kind of video, where it kind of shows how much assimilation has happened in our society, where like the great life event of a bar mitzvah is so assimilated where it becomes just like a party with like a Jimmy Kimmel theme versus like a Torah theme. Like that.
I understand that, but that's in a certain sense self-evident. But the fact that whether you observe it or not, everybody feels on some level a little excitement because Jimmy Kimmel is interested in us and is celebrating what we think is a celebration. You know, even whether it might be in a more reform, assimilated kind of way. You know what I'm saying?
There's something about that analogy that isn't working for me.
Dead.
On the ritual impurity side, you can't say someone became not Jewish, then they became nothing, then they became positively Jewish. So if you apply that on the ritual side, what is it that's in the negative state that goes neutral then positive?
I don't understand.
When applying this idea of purity, impurity in the koshering process to vessels,
yes,
we're saying that you elevate it from a negative state to a neutral state to a positive state.
Right.
So if you apply that to ritual impurity to a person, granted you're not toveling them, but what's the intermediary state?
Well, a person is being toveled in ritual impurity.
Okay, what's the negative state for someone in ritual impurity?
Well, in regular ritual purity, he has come in contact with a dead body. That's a negative state. Now, on a halakhic level, he only has to rectify that if he wants to go into the temple, which is a more holy environment, okay? So therefore, he has to go through the process of, through the sprinkling on the third day and the seventh day, and then he has to go to the mikveh on the seventh day and get back to his he doesn't have he goes from negative pub because fundamentally his substratum is really he's a Jew.
Yeah, that's what was confusing me, because I'm like,
so the Jew,
there's a state missing here.
there's no three stages for the Jew. There's only two stages, negative to positive. With the vessel, which was owned by a Gentile, it has the identity through the absorption of the non-kosher food. Then by koshering it, you move it to a neutrality. It's now a neutral, called a parav thing. But now, whether biblically or rabbinically, there's an obligation to put the vessel into the mikvah to give it a positive state of Kedushas Yisrael. Very much like, it's like converting. You're converting the dishes in the same sense. You're giving it another identity. But I brought the Jimmy Kimmel point to bring out the idea is that unconsciously the draw toward the non-Jewish culture is immense. And I bought an example, which is like a very silly example, but it just shows the appeal. The appeal to go like the majority with all aspects of their culture, their food culture, their entertainment culture, their religious culture, everything is huge. And it's not limited to Jews. That's true for any minority culture. The nature of the minority culture is to be absorbed by the majority culture. That's why they call America the melting pot. All these different identities came in, Italians, then the Irish, and all these people, and they sort of merged together into sort of this blend of an American. And it's very hard to keep a religious, ethnic identity. So the Torah's manner is very powerful. It deals with the most fundamental need of man, which is food. And that's why, gosh, you know, when a person has non-Jewish friends, kosher is a big problem. And it's not by design. It's by on purpose. You know what I'm saying? Because, all right, so we'll go to your house. Let's see, invite them to dinner to your house. What are they going to want to do? They're going to want to reciprocate. So the Torah is creating a cultural independence and blocking yes to relationships, but no to assimilation, acculturation. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think I was saying a similar thing earlier.
Okay, but no, the word, so by the key element here, the word tahara, is used in two senses. One is from the ritual level, and one is a tahara of the mind or of the mentality. You know what I'm saying? Here, thinking about being purified not from a metaphysical or legal status of being connected to a dead body, but a tahara, a purity from the cultural influences, particularly the cultural influence through the food culture, which allows a cultural independence, which is so vital to keep the Jewish people independent and autonomous. So, which is not simple.
So, did the Midianites wine and dine the Jews? Is that part of this?
They did do that, yes.
Okay.
That was my hint. They didn't just go from sex to idolatry. They had sex, then they invited them to their idolatrous feasts. That's part of the cultural draw. They didn't just seduce them. It was part of their whole involvement. So that's a major, the appeal of dining with the Gentiles is a very, very important thing. It really means they creating a brotherhood of man.
Then why do we have the extra stringency with Mavushal of doing that if food is already so restricted?
So that came later. From the Torah, the only wine you cannot drink is wine that was used or designated for idolatrous service. That was it. Fast forward to the destruction of the Second Temple period. Now the Jews, under Roman domination, are going to be sent out to the four corners of the earth, right? And the rabbis, the Sanhedrin of the time, was very worried that the Jewish people are going to not make it through this exile. They're going to get absorbed, and then they're going to be lost. So they create a number of gezeirot, acts of legislation, to keep them intact, following the same idea. So they said any wine that a non-Jew touches or pours becomes forbidden, even though there's nothing wrong with the wine, even though it's not due for idolatry, right? But it was also important that they want to make you to have economic relations with the non-Jews. So they said the inferior wine, i.e. wine that is boiled, pasteurized, could be permitted to drink with the Gentile. But the better wine, which is not pasteurized, which is the wine that you can continue to ferment and gain character in the bottle, that is forbidden. So if a non-Jew, if it's uncorked, lifts it up, gives it a shake, or even pours it, that wine is not usable. That was to create a sort of a blockage for intermarriage. Because if you're going to drink with them, you're going to date them, and you will marry them. So to food, that kosher food that is cooked from beginning to end by a non-Jew cannot be eaten by a Jew. Because if you're going to be going over to the girl's apartment and she's cooking kosher food for you and she's pouring wine, and you're eating her bread, the three basic staples, you're going to get married to her. So they create all these you know, if you date non-Jews, you marry non-Jews. I mean, that's just it. And unfortunately, it's a sociological reality. Okay. To create a little speed bump, if you will, that, oh, you can, if a non-Jew cooks your food, it's fine, provide you're involved in the cooking. You flip the steak, you turn on the fire, etc. oh, if the bread is made by a bakery, that's fine. But it's made by an individual, not fine. We're talking about if it's all individual ingredients. It was the same idea to create through these extensions of the kosher laws to maintain Jewish a central identity.
Is the assumption there that non-Jews wouldn't want to have like mevushal wine?
In other words, the Chachamim have the liberty to make the rules any way they want, so they only forbid the better wine. They didn't make like the inferior wine. They didn't forbid. If you take a wine, you bring it up to 180 degrees or 200 degrees, it takes away an element of its excellence. That's why when you go to Israel, when you went with me to Israel, we went to the Gush Etzion winery, went to the Shiloh winery, all that was not Mavushal wine. It was awesome wine. Now, they've worked it out because of tremendous technology that even if it's pasteurized, it can still be good wine. You know what I'm saying? But that's a workaround. You know what I'm saying? But the thing is true. In other words, how many times have you had, if you deal with non-Jews, you have awkwardness with kosher? Right? Let me give you an example, right? You go to one a business thing and you're eating kosher food. You can't eat, everybody's having steaks. And either you're eating something which is, you know, from a separate company, you're getting Le Marais to send you the high-end, you know, preheated meals, and you're there taking off the tinfoil, you know, you look like a weirdo, you know. Now, if you work for a company, they know that they don't care. But it's a little bit awkward, but it's designed to be awkward. It's not by not by accident. It's to create a little bit of social friction. Also, to go out drinking with non-Jews in a bar, it has a lot of problems. There are certain ways you can work it all out, but I'm just saying it's the same idea. If you're hanging out and drinking with Goyim, eating with Goyim, it's not going to end well. Look at American Jewry. In the non-Orthodox world, you're looking at a 71% intermarriage rate. There are members in MJE, the General Fellowship Community, that they are the only child of the family who's not married to a non-Jew, including their parents, who divorced and married Goyim. Okay? I am not making this stuff up. So the reality of acculturation, assimilation, is something which you don't have to, you know, squint to try to find. It is everywhere. And in every family, there's not one family. I mean, it's like the rare family that doesn't have any assimilation in their, like, extended cousins. Impossible. You guys agree?
But those kind of numbers, who can't?
Right, it's a fact. So you understand that the kosher is a fantastic vehicle. Now, if a person doesn't keep kosher, it's not going to work, obviously, you know. But when the Jews were still, or the Jews that are more halachically minded, it has an effect. It has an impact. And that's its design. And God says, I will separate you from the nations by keeping your distinct, independent food culture, where food is designed for learning, mitzvot, celebrations of holidays, bring in the poor. It's a different idea. That's the basic idea in a nutshell.
Okay.
All right, guys. Have a great night. And we will. I'll see a bunch of you guys tomorrow.
All right. See you tomorrow.
Thank you, Rabbi. See you tomorrow.
Bye. Bye.